During the 1920s, the culture of the United States went through some radical changes, and so did the soundtrack. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, jazz in Iowa, from the hot jazz of the 20s to the big band sound of the 30s and 40s. I'll talk with Josh Duffy, music director of the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival in Davenport, and John Benoit, professor of music at Simpson College. We'll talk about how the scene exploded as jazz spread around the United States. And I'll also talk with Jim Oates, the leader of the Des Moines Big Band, about keeping the big band culture alive. We also want to hear your memories. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When you think about jazz, you probably think about New Orleans or New York City. But in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, musicians in Iowa and the surrounding states kept Iowans dancing in ballrooms, hotel dining rooms, high school gymnasiums, and by playing on local radio. This hour, jazz in Iowa, from the hot jazz of the 20s to the big band sound of the 30s and 40s. Later in the hour, I'll also talk with Jim Oates, who's leader of the Des Moines Big Band, about keeping the big band culture alive today. Right now, we're going to look into the past with my guests, Josh Duffy, music director of the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival in Davenport. Hello, Josh.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Also with us is John Benoit, professor of music at Simpson College. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, let's go way back in time. 1917 is the date that is often given as really the time that jazz was born. But this culture, this kind of music, really spread quickly. Josh, where did it start and how did it come to Iowa?
Well, it started back in the New Orleans roots with a group called the Original Dixieland Jazz Band, and that was actually spelled with two S's instead of two Z's, led by a great cornetist by the name of Nick LaRocca. And Nick LaRocca had his band that was recording for the Victor Recording Company in the teens there, 1917, with it being the first jazz record. And it came to Iowa. And again, with me being from Davenport, I always mention, of course, Bix Beiderbecke, and he's known worldwide these days as being one of the most founding fathers of the jazz cornet. Louis Armstrong loved his playing. Well, he actually wasn't a cornet player when he began. He was a piano player, but he picked up the cornet by listening to Nick LaRocca play on the records with the ODJB from the 1910s. And some of Bix's first recordings with the Wolverine Orchestra for the Jeanette label actually paid homage to the Original Dixieland Jazz Band. So it came to Iowa that way with that Bix connection, as well as Glenn Miller being from Clarinda, Iowa. He was playing with a group called Boyd Center and his Centipedes. And I actually have a great photo of them from Sioux City, Iowa. It's just a smaller group, about a 5 or 6 piece jazz ensemble. So 1920s jazz was really coming into Iowa at that point. It was, of course, coming up the river from New Orleans to Chicago, and then it made its way across Chicago to good old Davenport here. And it was just, again, spreading like wildfire. People were buying these records at five and dime stores and being able to play them on their Victrolas at home and just kind of getting used to the music, because it was kind of the new music as people see new music of today. It just takes a little bit of getting used to, but once they got used to it, they absolutely loved it.
Well, you know, and I've listened to a lot of these old records, and of course, time has not been kind to old records, but even then, the recordings weren't that clear. It wasn't exactly a crisp, clear sound. It just seems amazing to me that these musicians all over the country could listen to these records, imitate it, and improve upon it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and what they did with recordings back then, with recording them on shellac, and it was a big process and a big to-do, because they had to go into the studio and they had about 3 minutes to record, because that's all a 78 RPM record would hold, roughly. And they would get into that studio and make this recording, and they had to have their solo down, because if they missed a note or if they missed a solo, there wasn't, okay, let's go back and we're going to erase that like today digitally, like, oh, we can easily plug that in somewhere. They had to have that down precise, and so they didn't waste time, they didn't waste money, and they didn't waste a record. So there were very few bad takes that bands would do. they would have a lot of takes that would not be submitted, but they'd be like a take B or a take C. And so they had a chance to run through it, but they didn't go in there and waste time. But the band's perfection to the notes and the music was really impressive if you hear it on the recordings. And yeah, they still hold up over 80 years stronger. Those arrangements still sound as fresh as ever. And people are getting re-energized in those, a lot of young people these days, especially with the hype of Boardwalk Empire and other shows bringing back that roaring 20s music.
And John, I know that your dad actually collected antique phonographs. You probably listened to a lot of these recordings when you were growing up.
I did. At the time, I really wasn't into the music as much as I just had fun putting records on and winding them up and listening to them. You know, it was more fun playing the machine than actually listening to the music. But I think, you know, it planted a seed. It got those sounds in my ear. And later in my life, when I was a little more open to it, I really became interested in the music. Again.
Well, let's talk about that 20s sound, because, of course, there were a lot of new things going on. People were really experimenting. I think that most of us are more familiar with the big band sound of the 30s and the 40s. That's something that has really endured in popular culture more. But let's talk about these small ensembles of the 20s. And they really were often small ensembles, right, Josh?
Yeah, and bands of those days were smaller. You have to remember that they were starting to bridge that gap between the classical listener and the jazz listener. And the ensemble could be anywhere from a 12 to 13-piece orchestra, which would be 13 musicians, down to sometimes as little as four guys in the band, which would be a rhythm section and a horn player. Whatever they would want to do to get a group size in there, depending on the dance hall, because that's, again, what they were playing in those days, were those dance halls and those ballrooms, because that was the main source of entertainment, was taking your date out and going dancing. It wasn't hopping on the phone like we do today or hopping on the TV. I mean, it was going out, and that was nightly going out to hear these great bands that were touring around and playing at the ballrooms on a nightly basis. And, yeah, bands could be any size. They started getting bigger as the 1920s went on, and the arrangements started becoming more full with voicings, with saxophones, and with trumpets, and with trombones. And so as you started to go on in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, the groups just kept getting bigger and bigger with the amount of musicians. So when you have that small group, that was kind of the main focus of the late teens, very early 20s, with the bands just playing that brand new jazz music and getting it out and working on their improvisation and taking a melody and doing their own little thing on top of that melody. And when you think about jazz improvisation of the early days, it's not like a Miles Davis or John Coltrane where you hear a whole bunch of notes and going over chord progressions. They were still using chord progressions, but you can really hear the melody in their solo. That's one thing with later jazz you don't hear as much.
Well, and Josh, I know that you are a drummer and you've paid special attention to the drummers of the 1920s, and they were working under very different conditions than drummers of today. Can you describe what tools they would have had to work with?
Oh, yeah. A drummer back in the, like, let's say the 1910s, 20s, they would have pretty much had a 28-inch bass drum, so a huge bass drum, a snare drum, possibly one or two what they call choke cymbals, like a crash cymbal that you would just choke it with your drumstick. A wood block, possibly a cowbell, and like a whip cracks, like little sound effects and little whistles, but that was it. There was no ride cymbal, there was no hi-hat, there were no tom-toms like you see the drummers of the big band era having. So they were more or less just that timekeeper really driving the band, but then they had to think up of these little effects that they could throw into the music. That's what a lot of people don't realize, is it wasn't all swinging, and that's, I think, the one misconception when people hear 20s music and then they see a drummer playing with a hi-hat and a ride cymbal swinging. It's like, no, that's the swing era. You got to go way back into the teens and 20s to see that the drum kit was just bare bones. Everything pretty much mounted to the bass drum, and that's why they called those little instruments traps, is that they would just all mount to that bass drum. And that's all the drummer had to use on a particular recording session as well. Because they thought that the needle was going to be bouncing everywhere, so they would usually let the drummer only play just a cymbal and a woodblock on early recordings. But when they played live performances, they would just have just those basic drum parts, as I mentioned. And yeah, it's a bare-bones style of playing, but it's one of the most difficult styles of playing out there, I believe.
Well, there must have been a lot of innovation going on as well, with these drummers having an idea of the sound that they wanted to make and needing the tools to make that sound.
Oh, exactly. They really made those drums musical, and they really made them speak. I was good friends with Louis Belson because he's a Mullen graduate like I was, and was Duke Ellington's drummer for years. And he and I talked about that, about Baby Dodds and Duke Singleton from New Orleans, as well as the other drummers. And he said those drummers back in the 1910s and 20s were some of the most musical drummers that he had ever heard on a 78 in his entire life. He said they got more music out of those drums than I could get out of all of my drums with tom-tom cymbals. He said it blew me away what they could get away with. But that's the thing, is they really had to use their mind and be creative and think of what sounds they could get out of such minimal equipment for their instrument.
And you collect drums from the 1920s. Have you found anything that is particularly bizarre or kind of blew your mind?
Yeah, I actually just picked up another pair of them. They're weird. They're called Bach-in-a-Bach cymbals, and it's like Bach-a-da-Bach cymbals. And it's what Duke Singleton used on the Louis Armstrong Hot 7 recordings, which are some of the most pinnacle jazz recordings to listen to. And they're these little hand cymbals that look like a handle of a spatula with two probably 4-inch round metal cymbal discs. And they're almost like castanets, where you have a pair in each hand, and you just use your fingers to close them and open them so they hit and make sounds. And I found two pairs of those. And some people are like, what are those? And another one that's called the Billy Gladstone hand cymbals from the 1920s, which are very similar. They're a little bit bigger, but they have a handle that you can use, and they almost look like a pancake flipper. You can actually put batter in them and flip them, but you can use them for what they used for hot cymbal rips back in the 20s. So there are a lot of weird percussion instruments from the 1910s and 20s.
Well, and of course, the percussion instruments weren't the only difference, and we're just going to start this topic. John and I want to take a break, and then we'll get back to it. But I know that there were a lot of other differences in the instrumentation as well. One of the differences was that they would often replace guitar with banjo when they went into the studio?
That's right. Well, sorry. Yeah, go ahead, John.
That's correct. In the early days, the guitar didn't record as well as the banjo. The earliest recordings were mechanical recordings. You've all seen, the Victor phonograph with the horn on it, Morning Glory horn. Well, the recording process was kind of the reverse of that. They had a horn that they would play into, and it would physically, carve the groove on the record. And guitar just and string bass was another instrument, just did not record very well. So in the very earliest recordings, banjo was by far preferred.
Interesting. We're going to talk about some of the other interesting instrumentations of early jazz in the 1920s when we get back from a break. We're going to go out to the break with Bix Beiderbecke and his gang. This is from 1927 at the Jazz Band Ball. My guests today are Josh Duffy, music director of the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival in Davenport, and John Benoit, professor of music at Simpson College. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about jazz in Iowa in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. In a few minutes, we'll talk about big band jazz today. I'll talk with Jim Oates, leader of the Des Moines Big Band, as he's keeping that culture alive in Des Moines and Iowa. With me right now are Josh Duffy, music director of the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival in Davenport, and John Benoit, professor of music at Simpson College. We also want to hear from you this hour. Do you have memories of going to hear these bands at dance halls in the 40s, perhaps? Do you have memories of your parents talking about going to hear these bands? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And just before the break, we were talking about some of the really interesting instrumentation of the jazz in the 1920s and how that evolved in the 30s and 40s. And another one of the very interesting things about the jazz from the 20s, John, is that so often the bass instrument was not a bass instrument that we would think of today. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, the bass instrument that we'd use today is a string bass or maybe an electric bass. But as I said earlier, the string bass, especially in the early 20s recordings, didn't have a lot of carrying power. It just did not register as sharply as the other instruments did. And so they favored the tuba. And then also the bass sax was used in a number of recordings. And then also the piano, the pianist's left hand would be pounding out a bass line as well. And so they would get their bass voices that way. The music of the time emphasized kind of two bass notes per bar instead of four. And for wind players, that means you have a little more opportunity to catch a breath here and there, whereas in the swing style that evolved in the 30s and beyond, it's this constant four beats per bar, and it's really difficult to maintain that on a wind instrument.
I'm sure. I mean, I think you would have to take turns to be able to maintain that.
Right, and the wind instruments are a little bit punchy as a bass instrument in later styles of music, swing styles. But in the music in the 1920s, that punchiness was just what was called for.
Let's go to the phone. Sarah is on the line in Ames. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I wanted to let you know that when I was growing up, we always heard that my grandma, who was a child during the 1930s and 40s, was out in the ballrooms in Iowa cutting it up. But I didn't learn that until after I started swing dancing in high school. There's still a global Lindy Hop and dance scene around the world, and there's definitely an active one here in Iowa. We get out and we, you know, do dances like Lindy Hop, Charleston, Balboa, Jitterbug. So it's great to hear your show.
All right.
Talking about jazz in Iowa.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Sarah. And, you know, even with the resurgence of this kind of music, and there was a pretty big resurgence of swing dancing in the 90s. And of course, there are these groups around the country who love to do swing dancing and jitterbug and that kind of thing. But, you know, Josh, earlier you were talking about what the music scene was like in the 20s and into the 30s and 40s. I mean, there were musical performances all the time in all kinds of venues, right?
Oh, that's exactly right. You could be walking down the street, especially these days, you see more live jazz starting to just pop up because a lot of the college kids are really getting into it. I know right there in Iowa City, my group called the Greystone Monarchs played for the Hawkeye Swing Dance Festival, which takes place in April. And it's the college kids coming from all over, as well as I believe some high school kids too, and they're swing dancing. And a lot of the older generation, they're like, this is so exciting seeing these young kids dancing and getting into this music again, because they felt that it was kind of going on the way out. No one was kind of keeping that torch going with keeping it alive. But they see these young kids that are definitely keeping it alive, and they're getting excited, and they're finding venues from Des Moines to Davenport here to Chicago, all over the place. There's just people dancing and really just getting back into the music. So at any venue, I mean, you could go to like a pasta shop, to a pizza place, to a coffee shop. They're anywhere that they can play that music and hear it and dance, they're there doing it.
Well, you mentioned earlier how in the 20s it was really a transition between classical music to jazz music as far as popular culture and what people were listening to at home and going out to see or hear. Now, I imagine that this shift wasn't welcomed by everyone. Do we have some information about what Iowans thought about this new kind of music and this new kind of dancing?
Go ahead, go for it, John. Yeah, this would be good for you.
Well, I was just going to say, I've been doing a little research into Iowa's town bands and also Chautauqua. And if you read some of the old newspapers, a lot of the people, especially who are involved in Chautauqua, really kind of looked down on jazz and would actually put in their advertisements that you would not hear any jazz at the Chautauqua shows. And in that sense, it was a more wholesome form of entertainment. But that said, if you look at the actual Chautauqua programs, a lot of performers would sneak some popular tunes onto their performances because I think the audiences were really enjoyed those and looked for that kind of music as a form of relief from the other stuff they were hearing at the Chautauqua.
Well, and Josh, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to say, with a lot of that music, when I've been studying it, listening to a lot of my 78s, you find that the bands aren't just coming out playing this rip-roaring hot jazz music, especially at that time. It's more or less straight-laced, and it's not in your face. It's just, like, easy on the listener's ears. And so parents are like, oh, okay. And it's like on the last chorus out, like on a Sousa record, where he's increased the speed because they were running out of room on a record, so the Sousa march would increase the tempo. The dance band that was recording that record will all of a sudden get real hot and syncopated. So it becomes a little bit more like dance-like. So then people will be like, whoa, it adds a little lift to it, makes it hot. So they were more or less spoon-feeding the jazz into the listener's ear. So just shoving it right in their face right off the bat. And so that's how they were starting to get jazz into the mainstream of music with those records. And I feel it's like the last chorus would get really hot. And I noticed that on a lot of the early records.
Well, and Sarah brought up Jitterbug and, you know, the Lindy Hop and swing dancing, all of those kinds of dancing that developed in the 20s, 30s and 40s. I can imagine that there were people who didn't really look kindly on that kind of dancing either.
Yeah, I think one of the things, too, that emerges in the 1920s that really had not been a part of the musical scene, part of that was kind of a generation gap. You know, if you go back into the 1890s, the 19-teens, and so on, you find that older folks and younger folks are kind of listening to a lot of the same music. But as you start to get, especially with the release of the original Dixieland Jazz Band's new sound, you know, that caught on, that you find more and more there's a divide between what young people are listening to and older people. And I think that kind of fed into some of the animosity that was expressed toward jazz.
Now, in the 30s and 40s, there continued to be a lot of local performances. There developed a culture in all parts of the country where there were regional bands who would travel a circuit. So in Iowa, they would travel through Iowa and North Dakota and South Dakota and Nebraska and back around. There were different booking companies that had different bands in their stables. And a lot of the bands that played in the Midwest during that time never really hit it big. It was kind of a region that was overlooked. They might get called up to Chicago if they were lucky, but most of them didn't get lucky. Lawrence Welk, though, is one that got lucky. His band was in this region. Of course, he was from North Dakota. And as these bands traveled around the Midwest and played their music, do either one of you know much about how the music evolved in that time? We talked about how these bands got bigger. The arrangements called for more instruments. There was kind of a tighter sound. The instrumentation changed a little bit. John, can you weigh in on that?
I don't have a lot of information, but one thing I would say is probably for a lot of the territory bands, they did not get a whole lot bigger. The biggest big bands, you know, were the ones, the national bands, like the Benny Goodmans and the Glenn Millers and Tommy Dorsey's are making a lot of money. I think a lot of the territory bands were still a little bit more like the 10-piece, 12-piece bands that were a little bit more of the size of the 1920s bands.
Josh?
Yeah, I think as far as like with the territory bands too, I agree with that. And a lot of it, like they were defined like as you had like your Northeast territory bands, Southeast, Midwest, West Coast, Northwest, Southwest. So they're in those different territories there. I did notice with doing my research is that like you had out of New York a group called the Paul Specht Orchestra, which is a nice dance band that would be roughly about 12 guys in that band. But then when Vic Spiderbeck came along and he was playing with the Gene Goldkett Orchestra in Detroit, normally the instrumentation was like three saxophones, two trumpets, one trombone, and then rhythm section of piano, banjo, tuba, and drums. When Vix came in, the Gene Goldkett Orchestra added him to that section, so now it became three trumpets, or two trumpets and one cornet, and then you had two trombones, so you now have added a brass player to make it five total instead of three, and then they kept that around, and a lot of bands were catching on to that sound that the Goldkett band had, so they were adding in those extra players as well to enhance their sound. It also meant that the arrangers, one of the pinnacle jazz arrangers was Bill Challis of the 1920s. He was writing parts and really starting to get that big band sound, and no one had really done that well until Bill Challis came along. Paul Whiteman had Bertie Groffé, who was his arranger, and yes, Paul Whiteman had a grand orchestra with strings and everything. And then the basic jazz band, though, was more or less that the Goldkett band took that mold and made it with the two trumpets, one cornet, two trombones, rhythm section, and three saxophones. And that turned into your swing band of the 1930s, where then they started adding more saxophones and adding more trumpet players. And yes, the players just by the late 30s, early 40s were five saxophones, four trumpets, four trombones, and a rhythm section. So you had a really big band and a bigger sound, which when you add more instruments, it just adds more color and adds a really beautiful sound to having that type of a band. With the 20s, though, you can still do that hot dance music with that type of instrumentation, and Bix and the other guys are brought in as the hot soloists. So you have the band playing the melody, and you have your hot soloist that augments the band as well.
I think one thing also that drove the growth and the size of the band, especially in the 1930s, is some of the dance halls in which these groups are playing were absolutely humongous. Like the Playmore Dance Hall in Kansas City, they'd have 2,500 couples or 2,500 people out for a dance in an evening, and you really needed a big band to fill that hall, especially in the days before everything was amplified.
Well, I actually wouldn't even be here without the Territory Bands because my grandfather was the leader of a dance band in the 30s, and my grandparents met at one of his performances. But sadly, a lot of these regional bands, their music has been lost. I did inherit my grandpa's collections of 78, so we'll play a little Nebby Orchestra here. This is from the 1930s, and I can't tell you exactly when it was recorded. I think he had 14 men in the band at this time. And again, this is from an old 78. He hailed from Ogden, Iowa, and did the whole region. That's a little bit of the Carl Nebby Orchestra. That was my grandpa's band in the 1930s. And also WOI Radio, which is part of Iowa Public Radio now, used to feature big bands from Iowa on their programs. Many other AM stations, of course, it was all AM back in that day, did that as well. The Carl Nebby Band played on WOI Radio, as well as many other big bands. But sadly, there really aren't a lot of recordings of these bands. There are a lot of recordings from this time, but not a lot of recordings of these regional bands that really survive. I suppose with your dad's collection of antique phonographs, you may have better access to this kind of thing, John, than most.
Well, most of the recordings that my dad had were, of the big name performers, national performers of the day. I think there probably was not as much of a market for the small recordings, and it costs money and it takes time to get into a studio. And I think a lot of these regional bands were just more focused on their work. One of the things that amazes me when I look back at this period is these bands were working 5, 6, 7 nights a week. All the little local dance halls, you could go dancing any night of the week in a state like Iowa. And they would have the local bands, but then sometimes they would catch some of the bigger name bands as they were passing through the state. And, today, a lot of, when we think about going out a lot, for a lot of folks, it's just going out on Friday or Saturday night. But back then it was any night of the week was a good night for dancing.
Well, and of course, the life of a musician who's trying to make a living today as a performing musician is grueling. The lives of these musicians was incredibly grueling, traveling around the region, trying to keep that large a band together. I mean, there are a lot of bands with 3 or 4 members who have a hard time staying together these days. So it must have been an incredibly difficult life.
Oh, it was much worse, I think, because, the roads were not as good. The vehicles were not as good, more prone to breakdowns, flat tires than we are today. Hotels, you couldn't always count on getting a good hotel, or there weren't convenience stores that were open 24 hours a day, so if you're hungry after the gig, you might have trouble finding something to eat. There's an interesting silent film that some students at Simpson made, and it was made in December, and it shows the bus coming from Des Moines into the town of Indianola, and the windows are completely frosted over on the inside of this bus. And I just think, what must it have been like to travel around in the wintertime back in those days?
Wow. Well, we're nearly out of time. As I mentioned earlier, I'm going to talk with Jim Oates, leader of the Des Moines Big Band, here in just a second. Before we go, though, you mentioned, there are places where you can hear this music. It has come up again and again in pop culture. It's used to set a scene. But why should I listen back to this jazz music of the 20s and 30s? What about it do you think is still special today? John?
Well, one thing I would mention is that the music of the 20s and 30s, of the jazz of that period, was also the popular music of the day. So it wasn't just sort of a niche music or an art music that that people who appreciate jazz are into, everyone was listening to this. And the music is very topical. If you look at what some of the songs they write about, they're dealing with all sorts of references to things that are happening in the culture at the time. And you can really learn a lot of history, I think, just by listening to this music.
Josh?
Yeah, I think with this music, this is one true form of American music. And it's something that, yes, we can call our own, but it's just as lively and exciting as it was the day that it was being written. So when this composer and lyricist were actually getting together to make this song, it was the same person or two different people, they really put a lot of thought into it. And the music has stood the test of time for all of these years. And when you hear it live and in person, it just blows you away, because you don't hear it on mainstream radio today. About the only way you can hear it is to buy a CD or go on iTunes or actually hear a band playing it live. But I think once people see and hear this music, they just get entranced with it. There's some mystery about it that they just absolutely love, and they just keep coming back because they want to hear more and more of it.
Josh Duffy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Josh Duffy is music director of the Bix Beiderbecke Memorial Jazz Festival in Davenport and a drummer. John Benoit, thank you.
My pleasure.
John Benoit is professor of music at Simpson College and a musician himself, a trombone and a piano player. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Jim Oates, a trumpeter and the leader of the Des Moines Big Band. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, and we'll go out with an Iowan who did make it big. This is the Glenn Miller Orchestra in the Mood. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The heyday of the big band had already passed when Jim Oates came of age, but he caught the bug anyway and is now doing a great deal to keep the culture alive as the leader of the Des Moines Big Band. He's also a trumpet professor at Simpson College. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And Jim, you come from a family of musicians. Your dad was a saxophone player, right?
Exactly. My father, Jack, had his own band here in the Des Moines area and was also an educator. But he got his start during World War II. He was in one of the broadcast bands in England, and he was doing that until he got TB right at the end of the war. And then while he was in the hospital for 4 years trying to kick that, he did arrangements for Lawrence Welk and shot craps with the other patients.
Wow. Was he the person who introduced you to this kind of music?
Absolutely. And, you know, they kind of joke that, my brother and my sisters, most of the time you have a classical upbringing, but my dad used more of the jazz genre to educate us. And so they always had a kind of a joke at the contest that the Oates kids would always swing their scales instead of playing, pretty straight like most of the classical musicians.
What kind of music did he like to play for you?
Well, he really loved Duke Ellington. He loved a lot of small group music, actually. Paul Desmond was one of his favorite saxophonists, and also, the people that played lead alto for all the big bands back in those times, he really listened to that. And so that was his upbringing, and he was being a saxophone player, he wanted me to play saxophone. So by the time it was time for me to start playing an instrument, he had bought a saxophone. And I said, hey, Dad, I don't want to play that. I want to play that trumpet. And so I guess just to see how serious I was, he made me buy my own horn. I found this old used cornet for, I thought, $30. And I'd been mowing yards. But I found out he subsidized it behind me, so just to see how serious I was.
A test. So at a time in the early 60s when Elvis Presley, the Beach Boys, Little Stevie Wonder, they were dominating the charts, and you went to see Woody Herman and his big band.
Exactly. I think it was 1963, and I went out to the Valair Ballroom, and I was 13 years old. And I remember just watching that band, listening to that band that night, and it just, I thought it was the greatest thing that I'd ever experienced in my life. And I remember standing out in the audience up around the kind of curved bandstand that they had, and I just remember telling myself that that's what I want to do. And so anyway, it was a big impact on me. And one of and actually four of the trumpet players that were playing in that band that night, I've had the opportunity to play with since then. And so, you know, you find people that are your idols. And if you have the opportunity later on in life to, play some music with them, that's something that's very memorable to me.
When you were 13 years old and you decided that's what you wanted to do, did you tell your dad that?
Well, maybe not right then, but I just, kind of kept it to myself and just started practicing a lot more because I thought the only way I was able to achieve that was to spend time in the practice room and kind of, get my skills together. And Bill Chase, who was the lead trumpet player with that band, I eventually went with his jazz rock band called Chase, and they had a big hit called Get It On and, nominated for a Grammy and all that. But I traveled with that band for a year, I think it was 1973, 74, until half the band was killed in a plane crash just north of the Iowa border up in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was that meant an awful lot to me because he really inspired me as a 13-year-old.
You know, in talking to musicians, one of the interesting things that I find is that often when they're talking to young people, they discourage young people from following in their footsteps. So the life of a musician is a really tough one. In many ways. Did you run into that, especially looking at a particular form that really was not as popular as it had been?
Well, there were a lot of years I probably could have been on food stamps, but I never did that. But I just, it may be sometimes be more creative when I was starving a little bit. And yes, it is it's a tough career to follow, and I have triplet boys that are all following that same footsteps. But I told them, I said, you have to make sure that this is something you want because it's not always going to be easy. If there's something that really grabs you in life, money is not the motivating factor for anybody in the arts. And I'm a pretty rich man right now. I feel like my life has had a lot of really great times and. So I feel really good about the decision that I made.
Now, you left Iowa. You lived in New York. Tell me a little bit about your early career.
Well, the first time I left Iowa was to go on the Chase Band. And I got a call. I was going to school at Drake University, and I got a call. I knew a couple of guys that were on that band, and then I answered the phone, and they said, well, is Jim there? And I said, well, this is Jim. And he said, well, this is Bill Chase. And I called to see if you were interested in joining my band. And I said, okay, who is this? I thought somebody was putting me on. And so I dropped out of school 2 weeks before finals. And my dad says, well, I know you have to do this, but you just got my last dime to go to school. And he kept that promise. But I traveled for a year, and then I kind of moved around a little bit, went to Denver, and I ended up in New York in the 80s, and that was, I tell you what, it was a humiliating place to be because there are so many great musicians there, and they don't all grow up in New York City. There were a lot of people that, there are quite a few Iowa musicians that are very successful there, and so I had a chance. I played with a couple of really great bands when I lived there that were just, I had to keep pinching myself to see if I was awake or not. And it was the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Jazz Orchestra, which probably is one of the most musical experiences I think I've ever had in my life. And then I also played with the Machito Latin Jazz Orchestra, which was a Grammy Award winner as well. And and Machito, Frank Grillo, was one of the greatest people I've ever worked for. And we did a lot of traveling to Europe. And we were on a three-month tour, I remember, one summer. And another idol of mine, Dizzy Gillespie, traveled with us for 1 week. And so that was one of the highlights of my life, was to be able to play with that great trumpet player for those 7 days when we were in France with him.
What brought you back to Iowa?
Well, I had been living in Honolulu for a couple of years and playing music there. And I was kind of, they call it the rock closing in on you, you know, when the island keeps getting smaller and smaller. And, you know, and I grew up with changes of weather, and I kind of miss that. And so anyway, I moved back to Iowa. I didn't move back. I was passing through. I was seeing my parents, and I was kind of going through, well, as trumpet players are embouchure. I was going through an embouchure change, and I ended up taking a little two-day-a-week elementary teaching job just for – I was just going to do it for 1 year so that I could take care of this change I was making. But in the meantime, I had met my wife, Lori, and then it went to 3 days a week, and then our triplet boys were born, and then it went to 5 days a week, and so I've been here ever since.
You've been leading the Des Moines Big Band since 1986?
87, but 87, I did it 3 years before that. So I've done about a total of 30 years, and it's kind of a labor of love. You know, we were all kind of weaned on this kind of music, and it's, you know, sometimes if you just wait for someone else to put it together and keep it going, most of the time you'll just be waiting by the phone. So I decided that somebody had to do it, so I took it over, and I've been doing it ever since. I don't know how much longer it'll last, but we play every Monday night. We've been doing that for, oh gosh, since 88, and right now we're playing at a great venue on Hickman, 8900 Hickman, called El Palacio, and we'll be working there tonight, and we play from 6:30 to 9:30 every Monday.
Well, when I think about, you mentioned Woody Herman earlier, I mean, there was a band with a really distinct sound, the heavy percussion, the bright trumpet sounds. Do you feel like the Des Moines Big Band has a signature sound, or do you try to cover all of these different?
Well, we absolutely have our own sound, but, you know, when we play music by some of these other bands, one of the things that is... You know, sometimes you look at these arrangements or pieces of music that you play. The music in jazz, a lot of times, is a vehicle for the improviser, the people that play the solos. So if you have, you know, a great piece of music that sets it up for the soloist but also has some great ensemble writing, those are the kind of tunes that we're looking for.
On the national level, there are a couple of bands that travel around in an effort to really keep – there are more than a couple, but there are a few really high-profile bands that travel around in an effort to keep this kind of music alive. The Preservation Hall Jazz Band is one. The Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra is another. When you look at the jazz scene, who do you see as really making an impact at keeping this sound alive?
Well – the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Band is now called the Village Vanguard Jazz Orchestra, and my brother and my brother-in-law are the leaders of that band, and I think that's still one of the greatest bands ever, and it plays every Monday night at the Village Vanguard down in the Village. And then Gordon Goodwin, there's all kinds of bands that are, you know, and every city usually has a band similar to ours that is, you know, keeping it alive there. There's, you know, Cleveland has one, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Kansas City. I mean, you can just go on and on. But I think it's, you know, like I said before, we're all weaned on this kind of music, and it's so exciting, and I guess the more people that are involved with it, it makes it harder to put together. So it's a real challenge when you have, you know, let's say a band that has about 18 individuals. And, you know, when I was on the road with Stan Kenton, I did that for 1 year. And that was kind of a little bit bigger band than most of them because we carried five trumpets, five trombones, and five saxes. And four rhythm. And so anyway, that was a real challenge. The bus got a little small sometimes.
I'm sure that's true. I've been looking at pictures of the Des Moines Big Band, and there are a number of people in your band who clearly have been at this a very long time. As some of the really great musicians of this kind age, as you see a lot of the people who are following this music age as well, where do you see the future of big band music?
I think it's always going to be around. I mean, it's been, you know, it keeps getting reinvented, I think. When I lived in Honolulu, I played with a rock and roll big band, which was really pretty interesting. And, you know, like we did Glenn Miller's In the Mood, but only did it as a rock and roll tune. And, you know, you can take some of these things that people have known from other bands and change them around, and it makes it kind of fun. But, the high schools and the colleges are really instrumental in keeping this music alive. And I tell you, I judge a lot of high school jazz contests, and I'd rather be the clinician to kind of work with them than being the judge. But those are the places I think where we're seeing so many strides that are being made. And, you know, you hear some of the college bands today that are just incredible. One of my boys is going to school, my son Eric, at UMKC in Kansas City, and they have a great director there, Bobby Watson, who is one of the greatest saxophonists. And then my son Chris is going to Temple University in Philadelphia, and my brother also teaches there. And Terrell Stafford, a great trumpet player, is the leader of the top band there. So, you know, it just goes on and on. California, my great friend Bobby Shue is with at USC, and so they're just all over. You know, Drake University has fine program. I'm going to be doing some things with the Johnson County Landmark in Iowa City for about a month, with a culmination at the Englert Theater with my brother Dick will be here as a guest soloist with the Iowa City Band, and also with UNI Jazz One. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. But I guess in answer to your question, Charity, I think the schools are really keeping the music alive.
With all the years that you've been performing, can you describe the feeling that you get when you're on stage and when you've got a great arrangement and the band is really tight and the room is just filled with this sound? What does that feel like?
Well, there's only a couple of things that I could probably or shouldn't say that are that good of a feeling when you're playing music for. It's just the time is electrifying, and you feel proud to be a part of something like that. And it's also, you know, it's really, you know, trying to play your best. And I think that is kind of a motto with a lot of really outstanding musicians, that every time they pick up their instrument, their goal is to play better than the last time they picked it up. So, it's never perfect. And so you just want to, make it a great experience for yourself, for the audience, and do justice to the music. I just remember that time playing with Dizzy Gillespie. You know, I had a realization in my life that, you know, I could practice every minute for the rest of my life, and I'd never be as good as Dizzy Gillespie, because Dizzy Gillespie is a one in how many million, you know. He's just one of the special things about being a human being, that you can't be jealous of it. All you can do is just look up to it and hope that you can steal some of the good things that they're doing and incorporate it into your own music.
Jim, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Charity.
Jim Oates, trumpeter and leader of the Des Moines Big Band, will go out with the sounds of the Des Moines Big Band, and you can find them on the web at DesMoinesBigBand.com. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.